Hey, everybody, and welcome to Learning from Smart People. I am your host, Rob Oliver, and today my guest is Joseph Hoag. He was born and raised in Iowa. He is a graduate of Iowa State University after he served in the Marine Corps. He worked in corporate finance and real estate before starting a career in investment analysis. He has appeared on Bloomberg and CNBC and led a team of equity analysts for a venture capital research firm. He has a master's degree in business and the Chartered Financial Analyst designation, which is abbreviated CFA. Joseph, welcome to the show, man.
Rob, thanks for having me. Love the theme music. Just kind of gets you in a happy, motivated mood, doesn't it?
I went through and it took me a long time to choose my music there, and I'm glad that you appreciate it. So good stuff. So let's start off with this. You're in the financial area, and everybody's kind of uncertain right now. We've got the pandemic, we've got all this stuff going on. And the question, like, in your professional opinion, where is the stock market right now? What's going on with stocks and the market?
Sure. Well, the stock market is a little bit crazy right now, just because we've seen this huge shift from kind of institutional investors, big money players, the pensions and the hedge funds, that kind of thing, kind of controlling the market, to really the power of the retail investor. You know, those Main Street investors that are investing those stimulus checks, right? Because the savings rate has jumped to over 13%. So people are saving 13% of their disposable income, whereas over the last couple of decades, it's been closer to 3 to 5% at the most. So you've got this huge wave of money coming in from Main Street investors. And that's great that people are investing, but they're tending to kind of just hop on the hottest stocks and the trends. And so they're pushing, you know, the Teslas and the Neos and the Amazons and all those hot stocks even higher without really knowing, some of the risks involved. So a lot of the market is terrifically expensive right now, and really dependent on more stimulus and lower interest rates. So what I tell investors is, you know, you don't worry about, or don't feel like you have to beat the market. You know, don't feel like you have to get a sixfold return every year in shares of Tesla or something else. Make sure that you're invested across stocks, bonds, and real estate to get kind of that diversified approach. Buy some funds, have some funds besides those individual stocks to really smooth out your portfolio.
So it sounds to me like what you're talking about is you almost have to have a goal in mind before you go in, because you can go in willy-nilly and like, I want some of this and I want some of that. But the reality is, what I'm kind of reading between the lines is some of those stocks, those individual stocks, may be overinflated, and there's going to be an adjustment period at some point because they're hot right now, but that's going to cool off. So how do you help people to set up those goals that kind of guide what they're doing with their investing?
Sure. And it's a great point, that idea of having a goal, because I see a lot of people investing almost like they're going on a road trip with no map or no destination, right? They're just setting out on the road. They're investing in these hot stocks and making great returns. And that's great. But, they're just chasing those returns because they have no idea where they want to be and what returns they actually need to get there. So, what ends up happening, obviously, is they just keep chasing those hot stocks. Eventually, the market is going to go down. The market doesn't go up forever. And those hot stocks get hit the hardest, right? And they find out after losing half their money in a stock market crash, they really didn't need those kinds of returns. They could have invested in a more diversified portfolio around some funds, around the broader market, and met those goals. So what I like to do is you start with those goals. You start with, what does retirement look like for you? What are some of those other goals, like education and buying a home, really look like to you? And much more than just putting something like that on paper, you have to build a story around that in your head, a mental picture of what life is like in retirement. What are you doing on a daily basis? And who are the people around you? And not only is this going to give you a better idea of how much money you need to meet that goal, so in retirement or to pay for your kids' education, then it's also going to be an excellent motivator for when, the stock market looks rough, or when savings gets tougher. You can, anytime that budget gets tight, you pull out that mental picture and you live in that moment, in that goal. And that's going to motivate you to keep investing, keep saving your money, and really get to where you need to be.
So you're talking about really having a long-term picture and kind of, it's interesting. I had on a guest a couple of weeks ago who was talking about, escaping the what he called owner prison, where someone is in a business and they're kind of locked into the business and they're working. And he talked about you start with the exit strategy in view and where do you want to be? And then you build the plan of your business around where you want to be. And it sounds like you're doing the same thing with stocks and with investing to say, okay, where do you want to be? And then you develop the investment strategy that's going to get you there. And that's good. That investing with a long-term view is going to be what ultimately helps you to get through those times when you're not getting, those major returns that you were, during times like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so not only is that mental picture going to be that motivation to keep on that path to your goal, but like I said, it's going to give you an idea of how much money you need. So if you need a certain amount of money to pay for retirement, pay for those daily expenses, then you can kind of map out, okay, how much do I have right now? How much am I able to save realistically every month for retirement and invest that? So what kind of a return do I need to get there? And what shocks people is that they need a much lower return than they might think. Tech stocks produced a 44% return last year, which is completely abnormal. And I think a lot of people are expecting that, are rushing into these hot tech names. But most people are surprised to hear that they need maybe 8 to 10% at the most, and usually even lower, usually even 6 to 8% annual return on their investments. And so once they figure that out, what that means is they can take it a little bit easier. They don't have to spend 10 hours a week watching stocks and trying to chase those returns. They can invest in that good group of ETFs, a few individual long-term stocks, and get that 7, 8, 10% return pretty easily over the long term, and not have to risk their money with, when is the next big bubble going to pop?
Yeah, and, all right, so you said ETF, and that means.
Okay, let's say an exchange traded fund, and they're really the evolution of the old mutual funds that we used to use, right? Back in the 60s when mutual funds came up, then it was just a great way to for everybody to invest in stocks without having to buy those individual stocks. It's just a group of stocks or bonds or other investments grouped into one, and then sold individually, so you could just buy this one group. And that's the same thing with an ETF. ETFs are less expensive than mutual funds are. You pay less taxes on them, but they trade just like stocks. So you can go into your broker platform or anything. You buy an ETF, say the Vanguard Real Estate ETF, which is a fund of about 200 real estate owning companies. And you buy that one stock, that one fund. It gives you exposure to all that real estate industry or that real estate sector. You collect a great dividend yield. I think it's about 4% right now, and you really benefit from that broad sector, that broad asset class of real estate, with just this one fund. So it's a great way to get that diversified approach. You build up maybe four or five funds of that, something like that. Maybe one stock fund, a bond fund, a real estate fund like that. Maybe a couple other ones, a dividend fund. And then you combine it with maybe 10 or 15 individual stocks at the most. And what this does is it's called the core satellite approach, right? You use 50 to 65% of your money in these five funds. Okay. It's going to give you the broad market returns, and really that stress-free investing strategy, because you've got your money spread across these five funds, which are in turn spread across the entire market, the entire bond market, the stock market, real estate market. And it really frees up your time too, because you've got most of your money in those funds. You can spend a little bit of time to pick out these 10 or 15 stocks that you really like and you really want to hold those forever. And so, it's stress-free because you're getting the market return on your funds, maybe a little bit extra on these stocks that you've got. And it just takes a lot less time than trying to chase the market and pick those 20 or 30 or 40 stocks every single month.
It makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that you mentioned in there was about real estate. And I mean, real estate typically has been something that only, you've got to have a fair bit of capital in order to invest in that. And it sounds like that's not so anymore.
No, and that's the great thing about these real estate investment trusts and the ETFs. So the ETF, like we talked about, that Vanguard ETF, ticker VNQ, that invests in over 200 real estate investment companies, right? And each of these individually are also separate companies that own real estate, usually commercial property. Some of them own residential as well. Rent those out, develop that business, and then pay out the majority of their cash flows as dividends. So you get very high dividend yields. All these stocks trade for 20, 30, 40 bucks. Maybe some of them are a little bit more expensive, a couple hundred, but it's obviously much easier than putting down that 10 or 20 or $30,000 down payment on a house or a commercial property.
Yep, makes a lot of sense. I want to kind of transition a little bit because you're doing the financial stuff and but you're doing this also as an online thing, and you're really making but you have an online presence that's huge. Can you talk about what your online presence is?
Sure. Well, I started my life as a commercial property analyst, and then moved into as an investment analyst working for venture capital and some of the bigger banks in wealth management. What I wanted to do was really reach out to the larger audience, the Main Street audience that I just couldn't reach with, that huge private wealth management practice. So I started some blogs, and since 2017, I've been on YouTube on the channel Let's Talk Money. And I love it to be able to bring that same wealth of knowledge, that experience in investing and making your money work for you, but to the Main Street audience, to the regular investors out there. So love the experience so far. We've passed 320,000 people in the community there on YouTube. We reach about 1.5 million views a month through the videos. And I just, like I said, I just love being able, that face-to-face connection, that relationship that you can build over video, and being able to connect in that way to people.
I mean, it's awesome. So in 4 years, you've built quite the community, and you're getting a lot of views on that. How long did it take you to really go from kind of zero to feasible with that?
Sure. Well, I think part of it was luck, and I hate saying that, but and of course, luck is just being prepared for when the opportunity comes along. But I grew very quickly within the first 4 or 5 months. Then I had the first few videos that really took off and gave the channel that momentum to reach more people. Generally, it does take upwards of a year or two to reach 1,000 subscribers, 1,000 followers on YouTube. I was able to do that in that 3 or 4 months. The first year I reached 33,500 subscribers. Second year was 133,000. It was almost exactly the 100,000 more. Then 167,000. And so it was a very quick progression, actually, and a steady progression. By no means did the channel go viral or any of the videos go viral, but it's just been a steady building over those little more than 3 years.
So it's interesting because a lot of people have the build where, they're putting out a number of videos and then one video hits, and that's kind of the momentum that propels them
Sure.
to become an online presence, to become an influencer. But you're talking, it's not that you've had one particular video that went viral. It's been a steady building process. Can you talk about how you do that, so that if there are folks out there that are interested in doing something like what you're doing, that they can learn from that.
Sure, absolutely. And it's a little bit of both. I did have those videos that did really well and built that momentum, but it has been a more steady progress than, say, just getting a million views on one video all of a sudden, like you hear about on the news all the time.
Sure.
So what I did is, and this is something that I suggest for all new YouTubers or creators there, is go on YouTube and find, four or five channels that are very similar to the topic or the niche that you want to talk about, right? And it's very important to pick a narrow topic, right? So I wouldn't talk about all of personal finance because it's just so broad that you can't really become an expert in everything personal finance. I would be, I would look at talking about investing or talking about making money, and maybe even a narrower topic than that, investing for millennials or men or women, or something a little bit more, a little bit narrower, so you can really serve that audience and become an expert for that specific audience and in that specific topic. And what you do is maybe you do a search for a keyword that's going to be very relevant to your videos and the topics you're talking about. And you're going to see channels come up often in different searches for those keywords, just the experts in that field, right? So then you're going to go to their channel, you're going to go to the videos that they've produced, and you can sort those by most popular, right? So once you get a group of maybe five or six other channels, you write down the titles to their top maybe 10 videos by views, and you're going to see common themes. You're going to see themes and topics and keywords pop up on pretty much every channel there, because there just happens to be topics or keywords or niche ideas that are popular on any channel within that topic, within that niche that you want to cover. And those are going to be your core videos. Those are going to be the videos you really spend the time on, really develop those, do 10 or 15 of those on those different topics, different keywords. And one of them is going to hit. One of them is going to start that momentum for you that is really going to take your channel higher, because people are searching for those topics. People are searching for those keywords and ideas.
Okay, that's kind of counterintuitive to me, and here's why. I'm thinking, okay, you've got other channels that are already established, that are already doing this. They have already put out the videos that are getting the views. And how do you, as a startup, kind of compete with them on those topics and on those keywords?
Sure. Well, a couple of points there. One is the fact that those topics or those keywords, those specific video ideas are popular across, three or four or five of those channels, of those most popular channels, tells you that there is demand for those videos. If it was just a matter of one person covering it and that was done, then it would be maybe on one channel and none of the others, because they would be the expert and that would be the end of it. But there is demand for these ideas from millions and tens of millions of people. So there is demand for those videos from different creators. Two, though, is also, it's an old truism that there's really nothing new, right? There's throughout history, we've talked about everything ad nauseum. Where you come in is your own personal experience, your own personal brand, and what you add to it through your own stories, right? Some of these other channels may have laid out the facts of the case for these topics very well, but maybe they did it in a dry, kind of boring way without stories. Maybe they don't have much of a personality. Your challenge as a new creator, especially against some of these other established channels, is to add your own flair to it. Add your own branding. Who are you as a person, and what are the values and ben or what are the values that you want your channel to represent?
Okay, one of the things that you mentioned in kind of your discussion was about the face-to-face and interactive way. When I think YouTube, I really think push technology. Like it's someone sitting in front of a camera and I talk to the camera and there isn't that interaction. How do you develop that interaction? Where does that come from?
Sure, and there's it's kind of a sliding scale, right? Isn't it? With the blogs, I come from a blogging background. Back in 2014, I started the blogs, and it's even less there, where it's just somebody reading the text on a page, right? Well, with video, you can get that a little bit more face-to-face feel. Okay, you're still in front of the people. They have more senses that they're consuming your content with. You can speak a little bit more colloquial. Or with your own euphemisms and slang and a little bit more conversational tone that goes a long way in really touching people more on a sentimental basis. But it also goes into using other forms of it. That's one reason why I always do a live stream at Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern, is to get a little bit more, it's a live interaction. You've got the chat coming up in real time. So that's a little bit closer interaction. You've got the comments within the videos that you interact with. You can also start you reaching out to people through other social media. So my my channel is closely related to my Facebook group, where it's a little bit more of a conversation. You know, it's a little bit more back and forth, not just between me and the followers, not the community, but within the community as well. So through all these ideas and all these platforms, then you build that a little bit more personal relationship with people rather than them just watching you in a video.
Yeah, it makes sense, because what you're doing there, and you talked about this a little bit, is building a community. And a community involves relationships and it involves two-way communication. And in that way, it's not just you pushing out the information. It's not just you being, it's not just you making a video, but now you're interacting with the people that are watching the videos, and you're having that regularly scheduled live experience is something that people come to expect and people can be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the most important things, aspects of this is thinking of it in those terms, in the terms of a community, not, I hate saying the word subscribers and followers, because it is that community feel. I get lots of ideas all the time from people commenting in the comments to the videos, as well as in the Facebook group. So it's that back and forth community, you help me, I help you kind of interaction.
I would imagine that that's got to be really huge, because I know that, I've got a podcast, I do some different things, and coming up with content is really difficult. But when you have that community and you've got the interaction with people and they're asking you questions or telling you what resonates with them, that's giving you the information to say, okay, this is something I need to continue to talk about, or this is something that I haven't addressed yet. And it's got to be very helpful in telling you where to go next.
Sure, absolutely. Give the people what they want, right? So whether through comments, through interactions, or just through the metrics on so for your podcast search, for your downloads, on a YouTube video would be things like views and comments and likes. People are going to tell you what they want to see and what they want more of. And you just follow that. Like I said, YouTube is a momentum machine. So you grab those two or three topics or niche that really work well for you in your community, in your channel, on your channel, and you just keep on making videos a little bit different. Approach it from a different angle. On top of that, so for example, we talked about finding those video ideas or those topics that just seem to work on every channel within that niche. Once you do get a few of those to hit, then you just follow those into different iterations of that. So if I have a dividend investing video that does really well and I see that people want that, then maybe I do a monthly dividend investing video or a highest yielding dividend stocks video. So it's all around that one niche idea, that one topic idea of dividend investing, just approaching it in different ways. And that's what's really going to build the momentum for your channel.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, because what you're saying is you put it out there and it's not a matter of no video is going to definitively cover the entire topic. So you put it out there. People said, this is information that we're looking for. You say, okay, how do I provide more information on that topic? I love it. Now, let me just ask, and I hesitate to ask this, do you have any tips or shortcuts for people that say, I want to do this, I want to become, I want to build a channel? Are there, what would you suggest?
Sure. Well, there's best practices you can follow. One of the frustrating things about YouTube is that, you can do these best practices, you can follow do all the right things, and it can still take a while. So I'd say just stick with it, give it at least a year of producing videos, producing content, and you will gain that momentum. But one of the things is quantity, and this is something that you're going to hear everybody say, no, quality over quantity. Just produce great episodes, even if you can only do it once a month or something, right? And the truth is that YouTube likes quantity. It likes that constant, consistent flow of videos coming out to bring people back to the platform. So if you can do one video a week used to be kind of the baseline. Now I'd say it's at least two a week. So I would try doing two a week, do them at this, publish them at the same time, same day, same hour every week. So you get kind of that TV schedule feel for people. You know, they know when's your next video coming out and when to be ready for it. If it's a little bit harder to to do 2 videos a week, maybe you do one content video and one interview video, right? Because interview video is a little bit easier. They don't take nearly as much editing, and just get them out. You know, work early, work ahead of schedule so you can get 2 or 3 weeks out scheduled in advance. So if something comes up, you don't fall behind or anything. The sweet spot for time seems to be around 8 to 12 minutes. You know, anything longer than 12 and it gets hard to keep people's attention for that long. Anything less than 8 and it doesn't really make YouTube a lot of money because of those ads, right? YouTube
Sure.
wants to show as many ads as possible. So it seems like, 8 to 12 minutes seems to be a good sweet spot for video length. Don't worry too much about getting everything perfect. You know, one of the biggest things I see is when people want to start a new channel, creators, then they spend hours and hours, 10, 12 hours on that first video or that first group of videos. And they never release them because they're not the perfect, perfect creations that they thought they would be, especially when they compare them against, creators or YouTube channels that have been up for years or more.
Sure.
Get the videos out. Just film a video, step in front of the camera and do your first 5 videos, from notes. Don't worry about editing even. Just get them out, get them published and start building that library of videos. Because that's really what you need to do is just get started.
Awesome, man. Listen, I feel like I could talk to you for another extensive period of time, but we're running short. So I want to say, Joseph, thank you so much for being on. If people are looking to find you, where can they find your YouTube channel? Where can they find you online?
Sure, it's my pleasure, and I love talking about this stuff. But I love seeing people join the community there on Let's Talk Money. That's on YouTube. So just head on over to YouTube and catch some of those videos, and be sure to click that subscribe button. Right. I also have the 3 blogs. So whether you're interested in personal finance or investing or making money online, I've got a blog for each of those. And you can join the Facebook group, which is Let's Talk Money Together.
Beautiful. And I'll happily put links to all 5 of those down in the show notes so that people can just go through the show notes and click on those and find you as easily as possible.
Excellent.
No problem. Joseph, thank you. We have come to the time for 3 questions to establish your humanity. You have established yourself as an expert through and through. Are you ready to establish yourself just as a person?
Ready as I can be, Rob. I think I hope it doesn't say something about my humanity if I stumble on these, but go ahead.
No problem. Easy question for you, and that is, would you rather trade intelligence for looks or looks for intelligence?
Intelligence bar none. I mean, looks are always fleeting anyway. And intelligence is here to stay. With intelligence, you can rationalize your looks away.
Okay, I completely agree with you. Easy question as well. What's the last thing that you recorded on TV?
Recorded off of TV. I guess it would be It's a Wonderful Life. Posting to just a general posting to Facebook about how much I enjoyed the movie, and it's one of my all-time favorites.
It's got to be. No, here's the question, and is it actually a Christmas movie?
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a good question. I mean, it's I guess as much a Christmas movie as Die Hard is. One of the top Christmas movies, I guess, if you could call it that.
Right.
But that's an interesting question because, it's only kind of ancillary attention to Christmas in the
Yeah,
movie.
it's set at Christmas time, but it's not really about Christmas. And so, yeah, and it's funny because that is the direct comparison I have. If It's a Wonderful Life is a Christmas movie, then Die Hard must be a Christmas movie as well.
Sure.
So you're from Iowa, out in the Midwest, and what food is it that says Midwest to you, that is a Midwest staple or something that you say, this is what says home to me.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm sure I'm going to peeve off all my city friends there in Des Moines, if you can call it a city, I guess. But I would have to say, yeah, corn on the cob, because it's, it is a staple of the Midwest there, even though we don't want to admit that we are a corn state. But yeah, corn on the cob. I guess you could go deep fried if you want to go to the fair and pretty much dunk anything and get deep fried donuts or deep fried butter. Would be one of the staples.
Excellent. So are like, is it the white sweet corn, or what kind of corn on the cob is it?
The sweet corn, the yellow.
Okay. Beautiful. Hey, Joseph, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate this. You've shared a lot of information, and I appreciate your willingness just to be open. Everybody go check out his YouTube channel, check him out on Facebook, as well as the blogs. I appreciate you all being here. I will remind you, as always, that when you stop learning, you stop living. Have a great day, everybody.